Hey, good morning. It's 11 o'clock and time for another Art Spotlight here on Red River Radio. I'm Kermit Poling, general manager here at Red River Radio, also a violinist and, well, associate conductor of the Shreveport Symphony Orchestra. I'll be playing violin this weekend. In the studio with me now, the music director of the Shreveport Symphony, Michael Butterman. We have a concert that is full of rich, I would say it's all romantic music in its way, even though from different periods, but looking forward to this one. But anyway, first of all, good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Kermit. Thanks for having me.
And I'll let you talk in the details about it, but I was kind of, amusing myself thinking about that between this concert, which we now have a replacement soloist, which is amazing how all that fills together. Because, violinists, they're just, easily replaceable.
No, not the, no, they're not.
As our pianist. And I was having the same situation, with one of my other orchestras and all of that. I mean, it's just been an interesting. That was related to travel, but I guess Jennifer Cole has had to cancel for other reasons. But talking about school, we got Brahms and Hindemith and Simon on a what I think is going to be a very cool concert.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with you. The best known piece for sure is the Brahms Violin Concerto, one of the big ones of the violin concerto repertoire, and we'll talk about that in a second. The first two pieces by Carlos Simon and Paul Hindemith are both works inspired by works of art. Carlos Simon's a living American composer, actually one of the most frequently performed American composers these days, I would say, living American composers. And his work is called The Block, which is based on a series of paintings by Romer Bearden, which were inspired by the Harlem Renaissance of the 40s and, well, the 40s primarily, 1940s. His artwork, if you know it, is kind of bold colors, sometimes mixed media with, with both paint and sometimes paper cuts and so on. And he has a series of six panels which depict, church and barbershop and bodega and various kinds of entity or basically buildings on a city block. And so there's a great deal of vibrancy and energy to the painting. And this piece by Carlos Simon has that same kind of a feel sonically. There is a great deal. There's a drum set that kind of lays down a groove.
Yeah, very, very jazzy.
Right, that we all have to kind of like lock into. So it's the whole thing feels very just energized, and there's lots of little snappy syncopations. The idea of different contrasts of media in the artwork, I think, is paralleled by we have strings, brass, percussion, all kind of treated like blocks of tone color in the Simon. So I think it's an interesting piece, one that just kind of it just kind of grabs you, and it's just 6 or 7 minutes to open the program, and then we go from that to a work inspired by Renaissance art.
Right.
The German Renaissance artist Matthias Grünewald, who is primarily famous for his altarpiece, Isenheim altarpiece, I believe it is. It has lots of components to it, but three of them in particular struck Paul Hindemith as he was writing. Well, Matthias Grünewald became the subject of an opera that he wrote called Matthias der Maler, Matthias the Painter. And this is music that he wrote for the concert hall because the opera itself was, as is always the case, it seems, having some troubles getting produced for various reasons. And, well, let's just get some music out there is what happened in the 1930s. This piece is, I think, very tuneful, very listenable, lots of interesting counterpoint. It's just a really fascinating piece. And I will say that I have to give credit to our brass section who have been, they have been lobbying for this piece for, I would say, at least a decade now. I
totally get why, too.
There's a lot. It's just a lot of really beautiful writing for the brass in this piece. But the piece itself is full. Historically, it was a real flashpoint in 1930s Germany.
Yes, right.
The idea of the opera centers around the question of an artist's obligation as a citizen when there is social upheaval, when there is, this was during the, the Peasants, I think it was, War. And Matthias Grünewald, the painter, at least in the imagination of Hindemith, is struggling with the question of whether he should take up arms and support the people's cause, or whether he should, how should we say, stick to painting and somehow advance the cause through his art. And this was a question that was on Hindemith's mind in the 1930s as the Nazis were on the rise. What was he supposed to do? Should he actively stand opposed to them, which he was, or should he, kind of just stick to writing his notes and rhythms and so on? And he had a champion in, of all people, Wilhelm Furtwängler, whom was in many ways perhaps unfairly associated with the Nazis, as someone who kind of played ball with them, as it were. But he, Furtwängler did, premiered this symphony very much against the will of the Nazi party, and ended up writing a, what you might call an op-ed in defense of it, and lost his job over this. So that's all to say that that the piece is fraught with historical significance, but from a musical standpoint, it is, I think, a real gem. And one of the favorite things I've discovered about this piece is that, you know, Leonard Bernstein created an entire young person's concert around this piece.
That I did not know.
Yes, called The Genius of Paul Hindemith. You can check it out on YouTube. And in which they play the entire Matthias Thermaler symphony along with some other works of Hindemith for these, 10 and 11-year-old kids.
Wow.
And somehow Bernstein, breaks it down in a way that, is. I mean, he expects a lot of them. It's clear, but he really, really believed in this piece and in Paul Hindemith in general. And it was just, it's fascinating to me to see that that piece was used as a young person's piece.
That's fascinating. Yeah. And from what I understand is the premiere that you were talking about, the Furtwängler premiere of the symphonic work, was it went over very well with the audience at the time. It was the opera a few years later that really, really annoyed the Nazis. And yet some of the music is there, because if I know correctly, that the first movement, the Angels part is the overture to the opera. I don't know the opera well enough to know that.
Right.
And I think the middle movement is an intermezzo in the middle of the opera.
Yes, exactly.
And I think the St. Anthony movement, the last movement, is a little,
it's a little bit of a synthesis of
some of that. However, you were talking about the brass. I mean, at the very end of the piece, when you have this incredible brass chorale after, you might expect, the Temptation, St. Anthony, it's a very busy movement. There's a lot going on there. And then all of a sudden we're seeing a vision of, it's an Alleluia, actually.
Yes,
Alleluia
exactly.
is written in there, and it's such an incredible movement. I don't know about you, but I get teary eyed when I hear that every time that we've gone through this, and imagine the struggles of the saint and all of that, and there we are. I just love that ending. So, there is a lot. There's a lot compacted into. I don't think it's that long of a work. 20 minutes?
No, it's 20, maybe? Not even a half hour, right? 29 minutes. But there's so much in it. The Nazis, among other things, they didn't like the message of the opera.
Sure.
Therefore, they didn't like this symphony either, because it was related to that. Although you don't get anything in the symphony that suggests stand up to Nazis.
Anything like that.
Nothing. It's just music. It's also, in some ways, quite conservative music. That they were denouncing him in the same way that Stalin denounced people like Shostakovich and Prokofiev from time to time as, writing, quote-unquote, degenerate. Music that in an authoritarian government, everything culturally is an instrument of the state, right? Or they wish it to be.
Yeah.
And so let's not challenge people. Let's write pretty kind of uplifting music that makes people feel good. That's what we want. We don't want any kind of music that will challenge your listening in any kind of way. Yeah. I suppose. But this piece, I don't think does it that much. There are some dissonances, but he's writing in a very, for the most part, very tonal language, and he uses counterpoint in the style, honestly, of Bach and Brahms, for that matter. It's very much a German work out of that Bach,
sure.
Haydn, Brahms continuum.
Yes.
No question about it. And it is, in some ways, for when it was written in the 1930s, it's a pretty conservative
work. which is why I think of it as, you know, an extension of Romanticism.
It is.
Very much so. So it's you know, it's not that far away, really, well, even in years, from Brahms,
right.
but it so it has that element of it, even though it's a 20th century work, but what a journey during that. I mean, it's like if you could take the romantic music, you know, further ahead. And of course, you know, we argue that with a lot of other composers too. But
sure.
But I think Hindemith had it pretty solid.
And he did. Yeah. He did indeed. And anyway, this is that is its connection to that German romantic tradition in particular. And even farther back. Of course, he makes use of even plain chant, right?
Yes, melody, right, exactly, right.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's super historically rooted. But that connection to composers like Brahms is why I thought, well, let's have the Brahms.
Let's have the Brahms, there you go.
Which is actually, even though it's not a symphony, it's kind of holding the place of a symphony as the main piece or the only piece on the second half of the program. It's actually the longest of the three pieces and one of the absolute gems of the masterpiece of the repertoire.
Yes,
a masterpiece.
Of course, yes.
One that was very much informed by a particular performer, Joachim, whom Brahms had, you know, collaborated with on many occasions. So it's a piece that you know, that I think violinists, although it's a very challenging work to play, of course, and one that, you know, that I think they enjoy playing because it you know, it has sort of the blessing of a master violinist. The cadenza that is always played it's actually Joachim's cadenza, if I'm not mistaken, but let's talk for a moment about our soloist.
So Jennifer Koh was supposed to make the trip, but now it, and I didn't say the interchangeability of violinists. We go from one incredible virtuoso to another incredible virtuoso, and both of them who've had performances here.
Yes.
So Francisco Fullana coming in.
Yeah.
I don't know how you wheeled and dealed that, but he's an amazing violinist.
He is. This is Wednesday morning. I wake up to a text that says Jennifer Koh is injured and can't play. That's all it said. So, okay, well, what do we do then? First of all, sorry to hear that. I gather, you know, she will be fine.
Yeah,
but but at any rate, she can't play this weekend with us. So the question is, okay, do we find somebody else who can play it, or do we try to substitute
with some other
piece of music, either orchestrally or what have you? So it's just a matter of getting on the horn with a bunch of folks that we have connections with, also waiting to hear back from Jennifer's manager as to whether they have any, you know, sort of alternatives to offer as well. But when it turned out that Francisco had, I've not done this piece with him, but he had sent me a recording of him playing it in Europe, a couple of years ago, I thought it was wonderful, and I immediately thought of him. The question always is, well, it's Wednesday, we need somebody here Friday to rehearse this. A, is anybody available? And B, do they feel like they can play the Brahms in 48 hours?
Yeah.
And fortunately, he happened to be nearby in San Antonio, but didn't have an obligation this weekend, and was kind of like,
that is amazing in and of itself.
I know it is. It really is. So we really just lucked out being able to thread the needle here with the right person, the right piece, the right timing. So it'll be exciting. I don't know the last time he played this piece, and I don't, it's not the kind of piece that I wouldn't think you would just fall out of bed and start playing. You know, it's a standard piece, but it's very, very.
Oh yes,
difficult.
No, it is. It is a hard concerto.
Yeah.
To play. But I mean, I would think it would stay somewhere near the top of pieces that get requested a lot, because it's such an incredible concerto. I mean, and there are sections, yes, it's very challenging, very virtuosic for the violinist, but also just some sublime beauty that you know, you were referring to, you know, the cadenza and all of that, but the moment right after the cadenza where everything comes back in is just, you know, it's just like an amazing moment. It's like, you know, not necessarily what you would expect. It's not, you know, big and bombastic coming back.
Right.
In,
right? No, we just kind of very, it's a march tranquillo. And so it's maybe the slowest portion of the, or part of the first movement is right after the cadenza. So he's kind of lulls us into a little bit of a dream and the orchestra joins.
Exactly. It's like, and that, you know, I mean, you know, traditional Brahms, but what to me, that just such great imagination to do that at that point and just lull everybody back. And of course it builds up to the end, but
it does, but it does. Yeah. But it's not quite what you would, it's not a formula, right?
Right. And, exactly. Exactly.
And then the second movement, I guess Brahms could really write a second movement orchestral solo in a, you know, in a concerto, couldn't he? I think of the beautiful cello solo in the second piano concerto. Unbelievable. In this one, we have a beautiful, beautiful oboe solo to open the second movement. Just, maybe the most beautiful part of this whole beautiful concerto. And then the last one has a little bit of that sort of Hungarian feel, I guess you would say, that Brahms was, it was so much a part of Brahms's just language from the time he was a young man playing concerts with this Hungarian violinist, Remenyi. Mm-hmm. It's just a great piece that I think Hindemith would be pleased to share the program with. One that I'm really, really glad to welcome Francisco back with. He played Mozart with us. He also then played the he played Lark Ascending, maybe, and also, does that sound right to you? The Four Seasons.
Four Seasons. That's the one that, which is what I immediately think of, because it was not something I was familiar with until
That's a piece he had recorded or has recorded. Anyway, it's just exciting to have him back, and just a fun person to be around, in addition to a wonderful musician. So looking forward to it.
And the concert is Saturday evening. That's tomorrow evening, of course. And that's at 7:30. That's at the Riverview Theater in downtown Shreveport. I should give the website, ShreveportSymphony.com. You can learn more there. You can get your tickets there, of course. And don't be confused by, one page has Francisco's picture. The other one has Jennifer's picture. You have to be there because those were done a while back. But in any case, the number to call is 8863.
8863 is
T-U-N-E. T-U-N-E. In fact, I was thinking about that the other day, and I thought, do phones really still have the letters on them? And I looked at my cell phone.
They do.
They do. They do. So the T-U-N-E still works just fine.
I should also, if I may, just briefly mention that we have a chamber concert.
Yes.
On Sunday at 3 o'clock at, that's Church of the Holy Cross, isn't it? I believe it is. And that is a program that's part of our Knoll Foundation Chamber Music series. That's going to be French music featuring a harp and strings. Really beautiful stuff. We have some Debussy work by a composer named Jean Krah that people may not know, but it's really, really, really lovely. So I hope people will also put that on their calendars. Again, that's a free program the very next day, Sunday at 3
and o'clock.
Yes,
and
unusually,
it is at the Church of the Holy Cross.
Church of the Holy Cross
down on Cotton Street,
exactly,
which is a great place for a concert. Oh, that'll be beautiful in there. Magnificent acoustics, and it's it's a church also with a lot of history too. So
true enough, absolutely.
So two concerts this weekend, presented by the Shreveport Symphony, and again the main series concert tomorrow evening at 7:30, and again, ShreveportSymphony.com is probably the easiest way to get the tickets.
Indeed, so it is.
Anything else you want to add?
It's going to be great, folks.
It is
a great musical weekend. Hope to see you there.
Absolutely. All right. And Michael Butterman has been my guest on the air, as he is frequently. And don't forget to get your tickets. Come Saturday afternoon. That's that concert. You don't need tickets for that. That's a free concert. And if you're with an organization and you want to be featured on a future spotlight, give us a call here at 800-552-8502, and you can be featured on a future spotlight. Thanks again, Michael.
Thank you.